Hello, and welcome once again to Culture Digitally, the podcast. This is Hector Postigo for culturedigitally.org. We were off for the month of August, but return to you now with our next installment of Conversations. Today, we have the pleasure of bringing you two distinguished scholars whose writing and research contributions have been generative in discussions on cultural production in the digital age. Our first guest is Ted Striffis from Indiana University's Department of Communication and Culture. He's the author of the book, The Late Age of Print, Everyday Book Culture from Consumerism to Control, from Columbia University Press. He's a contributor to culturedigitally.org and an author of his own blog at thelateageofprint.org. The Late Age of Print is all one word, .org. We have also with us Tarleton Gillespie. Tarleton, along with yours truly, is co-founder of Culture Digitally. He is the author of the book, Wired Shut, Copyright and the Shape of Digital Culture. Beyond being co-founder of Culture Digitally, he is a regular contributor to our blog as well as a host of other research collectives. His contributions to Culture Digitally have been featured in Salon.com and National Public Radio. Welcome to you both. If I could ask you now to introduce yourselves so that our listeners know your voices, we'll get the program started.
My name is Tarleton Gillespie. I'm from Cornell University and I am co-founder of Culture Digitally.
And I'm Ted Striffis at Indiana University in the Department of Communication and Culture.
Great. Thank you for those introductions. Today, we're going to be discussing the idea of the algorithm as a tool for thinking through the way technologies may be affecting cultural production. Or not necessarily affecting, that's a little bit deterministic, but how algorithms might be in conversation with the way we begin to produce culture, the way we begin to understand culture, and even the way we begin to define what culture is. I'd like to start with Ted, who developed the idea of algorithmic culture a few years back on his blog when he was, I think, speaking specifically about the Kindle. So I'll turn to you, Ted, and see if we can get us started.
Well, I started off by looking at Amazon.com in my book, The Late Age of Print, and there were lots of unanswered questions, especially about what goes on behind the scenes. And, you know, the example that you were referencing in your question had to do with the popular highlights feature of the Amazon Kindle, which essentially, you know, allows people who use Kindle to highlight passages, and then that information is sent back to Amazon.com where the information is aggregated. And what happens then is it gets piped back down to your Kindle so that the books that you read are pre-highlighted with the most popularly highlighted passages. Well, in any case, you know, to me, this became in the blog post a kind of weird example of the 19th century philosopher and school bureaucrat Matthew Arnold's principle of the best that has been thought and said, which is a very elite view of culture. Only here, rather than being the kind of work of a small cadre of typically white male literary critics, what you were seeing was a kind of grassroots voting, if you will, about what was the best that has been thought and said in a particular work that was appearing on the Kindle. Now, the complication here, though, is an interesting one. It's a kind of tension. And it has to do with whether or not what we're seeing here is an accurate reflection of what you might want to call the will of the people, you know, the highlighted passages, or if in fact it is the algorithm that is producing that which is popular. And this is something that Tarleton really kind of gets into in his own work on Twitter trending, and it's very fascinating. But the issue here really has to do with how good is the algorithm? If you know anything about the mathematical processes of algorithms, you know that they are constantly being tuned, they're constantly being improved, and so that, you know, the result that wasn't or that was being manifest earlier is not the same result necessarily that you're going to get today. I mean, Google in 1998 and its results would look very different than the Google of 2012, the content of the web notwithstanding. And so, you know, the issue has a lot to do with what the nature of an algorithm is. But the problem is, and this to me is the real political problem when we start to talk about algorithms, or at least one of the political problems, and that is we don't know how these things work by and large. I mean, we get little popular snippets from Wired Magazine and so forth about how these things take certain factors or certain signals into account. But by and large, unless you're in the know of Amazon or Google or one of those other companies, you really don't know the nature of the decision making that takes place vis-a-vis the algorithm.
Right. And I think that's a good segue into maybe we could get Tarleton to introduce his concepts now, because I think you're right. This is now we're talking about the politics, right? Because if these things are occluded from public view? These are really interesting questions. At least STS folks have been asking these questions about technology since, well, even since Langdon Winner, if not before, right? And now that we have these pervasive sort of cultural capture technologies that are, and ways of voting on what counts as culture, what counts as important, then the question of what the politics behind the design are really interesting. Charlton, you want to tell us a little bit more about your ideas?
Sure. Thanks. I came to this in a kind of parallel way. I was thinking about how major sites like YouTube and Facebook were managing what I might call bad content, right? All the kinds of things that they had set guidelines against. And that one of the things that these sites were beginning to do was beginning to use the algorithm itself as a way to patrol, monitor, and manage content that you weren't supposed to see. So for instance, YouTube started demoting videos that were not quite worthy of being removed, but were maybe sexually suggestive. And the reason they did that was because they didn't want it to show up on the front page. And the front page for new users was algorithmically produced. And if it was full of bikini videos, it might turn off the new user. So the very tool that in some other form or way we understand it is supposed to be the mechanistic measure of activity, right? These are the most watched. These are the most emailed. These are the most commented on. At the same time becomes a tool for blocking out, for choreographing access. And then this idea, this tension between the expectation and the promise that this algorithm is some sort of cool, neutral measure, and then the clear sense that it's also being used to intervene purposefully was quite interesting to me. And the work on Twitter Trends came about because there was a sort of brief controversy when Occupy Wall Street was going on very actively in New York and other cities around the US. And a number of people who were using Twitter quite heavily to find out about what's going on began to complain that Occupy or OWS or Occupy Wall Street as hashtags were not trending on Twitter. And they were seeing a huge amount of activity and saying, how come this isn't trending? And they went to this explanation that said that Twitter must be censoring them. And I thought that was a really interesting idea because, you know, to go to the answer of Twitter must be intervening to change the algorithm reveals a real faith, right? That if it weren't for some, sort of mustache twiddling intervention, this would otherwise accurately portray the fact that Occupy Wall Street was being heavily talked about. And there were two problems there. One was this problem that Ted's talking about, which is the criteria are not clear. So when people say trends, they kind of assume it's some measure of volume, but in fact, the trends algorithm measures something slightly different, something slightly more complicated, and something that Twitter can't quite explain, or else people would game the system. But the other is this question of depending on the algorithm as a kind of knowledge logic. And this is, to me, is the place where not only the sociology of technology can help us, but maybe the sociology of knowledge, that I'm trying to think about algorithm alongside of Ted's thinking about it as kind of a cultural mechanism, as a knowledge mechanism, right? A way in which we hope to know relevant things. That's a sort of most general way to say it that would include something like Twitter Trends, would include Google search results, would include your Facebook news feed. And this idea that, you know, we can't actually know what's most relevant in some sort of, measurable way. We can't know what search results are most relevant to your topic, right? That in fact is entirely a construct of Google's tool that is based on a measure that it says is an accurate measure of people's activity and their links and their clicks. But there's no outside measure for us to assess that. So we're left in a real classic knowledge problem. We want to know what's relevant in the world, whether it's what people are talking about on Twitter, whether it's what's hot on Facebook, whether it's what's the bestseller at Amazon. And we have measures by which we are promised that information. But those measures are built in a certain way. They are built in oblique places. And they are built with ideas about how to assess relevance. And those ideas themselves have political ramifications, right? So if it's built on the public will, that itself is a political choice. And the ability to measure the public will is itself politically loaded. If it's built on sort of expert opinion, if it's built on tallied opinion, if it has an idea about what counts as relevant that's built in, that to me is a kind of politics of knowledge as well as a politics of technology.
Let me ask both of you a question. And to what degree All right. So to what degree do you guys think this is about really the construction of publics then, right? So when an algorithm says X matters and Y does not, right? Or when it privileges a particular method of aggregation, of creating importance, let's say the number of people that like something versus the number of, versus how quickly it is liked over a short period of time. How are these algorithms constructing? Because to me, there's this idea of recognition, of like when someone sees something that they are part of, recognized in some formal way, they become, it's sort of this identity, this, right? It becomes a rhetorical device almost, the technology. The technology, the algorithm says, argues for, right, the validity of a particular community, the existence of a particular notion. So to what degree are we talking really about, not necessarily what is the case, as in, for example, knowledge, if there is such an absolute thing, but really about the social construction through a technological thing that makes us think of something as being the case, as being legitimate, both culturally or even in sort of politically, right? Are these algorithms constructing publics?
I think so. I think that you're absolutely right. There's certainly this sense of wanting to be visible. That's harder to say about Google search, but it's certainly about Facebook and about Twitter. And so, you know, the idea of I don't see Occupy Wall Street on the trends list is not just I'm worried this is an inaccurate tool. It's also where's my pet topic, right? How come I'm not visible on the network to more than just me? The place where I thought that I could find the argument about public construction most clearly in the Twitter case was that, you know, one of the criteria for Twitter trends, and again, they explain it in oblique terms, but not in sort of specific terms, is that they look for topics that seem to span pre-existing clusters, right? So if we're all talking about some sort of, you know, something that happened on TV last night, it's being talked about across groups that are not connected to each other. And that for them was a sort of measure of something that was hot. Right, and that's really interesting, and that worked against something like Occupy Wall Street, where the networks were already built. Twitter was, in fact, the means by which a lot of these people connected to Occupy. But once they're already connected, then by definition, things they talk about are not going to pop up as often. And I sort of posed the possibility they could have said, wouldn't it have been interesting to say that something that is talked about in a very heated way by an already existing network should also pop up, right? Because that would help me encounter things that I have no access to. But someone, somewhere, actively finds really important. Some community finds really important. And the fact that that group who I have no previous contact with is excited about some topic, maybe that should pop up for me. But that'd be a very different political philosophy about what trends is and what it's supposed to do than to say something that already exceeds connected networks should be more privileged.
Yeah, no, and I love the talking through of that you just gave, Tarleton. And what's interesting to me, two things. One is how, in a sense, if you're a pre-existing public that would be considered by Twitter to be insular, you essentially are not given the platform by which to be, you know, a kind of fully manifest public. It's an odd sort of spin on Chris Kelty's understanding of a recursive public, where, in a sense, the recursive public is working against the public. But the second thing that occurs to me, and this goes back to Hector's framing of the initial question or problem, has to do with the nature of technology and publics. You know, if you go read Michael Warner's wonderful book, The Letters of the Republic, one of the things that becomes abundantly clear there is the extent to which, you know, kind of U.S. political revolutionary culture was tied to the emergence of a reading public. But it's not tied to the emergence of a reading public only. It's tied to the emergence of a particular technology, which is to say the technology of print. And so when we start talking about the question of algorithms, I mean, one of the things that always comes up for me in talking through this issue, whether it's myself or with other people with whom I'm sharing my thoughts on the topic, is that kind of initial bristling at the new, you know, that this is a new technology or a relatively new technology. It's becoming increasingly ubiquitous, and it's something that we don't know a whole lot about. And so for me, there's been this kind of, you know, knee-jerk reaction always to say, you know, this is going to be a problem. This has lots of issues. This is, you know, something that could potentially be causing negative consequences in the political culture writ large. But then there's that moment where I go back to Michael Michael Warner's Letters of the Republic, which is all about the nature of the relationship of technology and public formation. Again, it's the technology of print there. And so, you know, I do want to say that in a sense, we have to recognize that there is a kind of connection or articulation taking place here when we're talking about algorithms. And it's the use of these computational processes as popularized by companies, publicly traded companies like Google and now Facebook, Amazon.com and others. And, you know, they have particular economic and political commitments or entailments, you know, that they are accountable to their shareholders, if nothing else, and that to greater and lesser degrees, those kinds of imperatives are going to inflect the decision-making that goes on in the algorithms. But in a sense, the algorithms themselves, or at least algorithms themselves, are politically agnostic. You know, as we used to say back in the days of early media studies, this is back in the 80s or 90s, you know, the politics of a text are not inscribed in the text. It has to do with the way in which the text is articulated or inflected in a particular cultural milieu. And I think the same lesson holds true for algorithms and talking about publics, that, you know, really it is the way in which these algorithms get taken up by particular companies or by particular actors or agents, rather than the algorithms themselves that, you know, have the political charge.
One of the ideas that I just thought about when you were saying that, it was the idea of the cultural life of an algorithm. Is that almost like what you're arguing, that, you know, there is this algorithm and it does X, Y, and Z, but then it has a cultural life as maybe we begin to understand what it's doing in terms of creating publics, in terms of creating a certain kind of politics, a certain kind of culture. But the flip side to that is that there is, you know, I mean, and Tarleton brings this up too, and I think you do as well, and I think we all sort of talked about this in some form or another, is that these platforms are commercial entities, are the products of a commercial enterprise, ultimately, right? Unless they're in a not-for-profit, you can say, you know, the IPO will tell the tale. Once the exuberance fades, will the company make money? And if it doesn't, who cares what the algorithm did or did not do, right? And so there seems to be a tension between this knowledge question, right? That we expect the algorithm to provide knowledge, right, of some sort, but at the same time, and so that expectation is something that we expect as consumers of the knowledge, right? But at the same time, the producers of the algorithm that are providing, right, the knowledge, are there to provide the kinds of knowledge that we would be willing to consume. Does that make sense? So is that what we're saying, that there is this underlying tension between what we expect the algorithm to do, what the algorithm is actually doing, and then what the algorithm does from a business perspective?
Yeah, I mean, that's in some ways one of the million-dollar questions of search. And I mean, you know, I don't remember who has made this argument. I know a number of people have, but Siva Vaidyanathan is one of them, and his book, Googleization of Everything. And, you know, one of the things that he makes clear in that book is that, you know, Google is not one thing, it's many things. And Eli Pariser makes essentially the same argument, that, you know, to the extent that Google personalizes search, you know, the search results that you get Hector or Tarleton are not going to be the same that I'm going to get, depending on location, your demographics, what you've searched for before, and so forth. And, you know, that in itself raises interesting questions, especially when we're starting to think about the cultural dimensions of algorithms, because, you know, historically, culture has always been about, at some level, sociality, you know, about some sense of shared meaning, purpose, set of understandings or practices. And, you know, when we get into this question of particularity and the ways in which algorithms are taking data that is specific to you and then trying to, you know, spit back out certain kinds of results, well, you know, that changes the question of culture in some ways, because it's not to say that there isn't that sense of sharedness. But it's inflected very differently than it has been before. Now, of course, when you spit that into the commercial orientation, you know, that raises the stakes even further, because then we're always talking about, you know, with Google advertising, also the same with Facebook, or, you know, those kinds of things. And to begin to complicate the picture even further with the commercial dimension, I think is paramount. But the other issue that you raise is a very important one, and that is in nonprofit sectors, you know, algorithms can do potentially very different work. And that's also why I'm intrigued by Pariser's latest project, Upworthy, which is essentially a kind of sharing and recommendation site that, to greater and lesser degrees, is not supposed to be beholden to the same kind of commercial enterprise that we would see on Google, Facebook, or other like-minded companies.
So the only thing I would add to that, I mean, I am fully behind the move in this discussion to say that we've got to focus on the fact that these are primarily commercial entities, and that puts us into a whole set of questions, not new questions exactly, with new inflections perhaps, where we have to think about, you know, just in the sense that a major journalistic organization had to balance an economic imperative with an equally economic imperative to stay legitimate or appear legitimate and expectations of knowledge and public commitment. Before we do that, I feel like I don't want to entirely leave the question of the materiality of the algorithm. So there is something interesting about the malleability of the algorithm and the ability to obscure the malleability of the algorithm and the copyability. So one of the problems with algorithms is that Twitter or Google or Facebook can't and don't want to reveal how they work, right? And in this, in a different sense than, you know, if I buy a VCR and took it home, you know, it's, I can find out how it works if I have the skills, I can open it up, right? And it's not going to change once I buy it. So if I start using Google and or Facebook and I start to feel like I understand the dynamics of that algorithm, I could get up tomorrow morning and Facebook can look exactly the same as it did yesterday, but the workings and the criteria of the search bar or the newsfeed could have completely changed. And so we have this very strange game where people try to divine or sort of, you know, reverse engineer how their tools work. And the reason they have to do that is because, you know, if someone were to reveal the criteria or reveal the code, then you've got Google too, or you've got the Google competitor, or you've got Facebook, you know, Prime. And that's different. You know, people did have to protect their printing presses, and they did have to protect their broadcasting, the infrastructure. But that was a very different kind of protection. That was protection from someone actually accessing yours, not the, I must literally not let you know how they work. And that, I think, changes things a little bit for how algorithms then work as a mechanism that we come to rely on as a sort of informing and sort of legitimating tool.
If I could add just one quick thing to that, too, there was a very interesting story within the last couple of months. I think it was maybe the May issue of Wired magazine. It could have been the June one. And it was about the way in which Google and other companies test tweaks to their algorithms. And one of the things that they say is, you know, the article says, is that they take, you know, samples of particular users and essentially they give them the new formula Google without ever telling them. And they test it out, see how it, you know, gets used, and they see, you know, the extent to which the results that are produced are in line with their expectations. And then what they do is they, you know, cancel it from that particular user who is being tested. And then, you know, eventually if it works out, they'll do a general rollout. But I mean, that's a very interesting issue too, that, you know, you are constantly, as a user of these services, potentially being experimented on. And one, you don't know you're being experimented on because there's no indication that says, oh, hey, you know, you're become a beta tester. Congratulations of, you know, tweak number 758 to the Google algorithm. But the other thing is that you also don't know then that the results that came up on your search, you know, 10 minutes ago might well be actually very different than the results that you would be producing, you know, an hour from now, because you are suddenly in this kind of new formulation of the algorithm. And so, you know, that's also very difficult too, because, you know, again, to go back to one of the issues here, there is a kind of epistemological realism here that I think predominates, if not necessarily in the realm of search, then in people's certain expectations of it, you know, that you are getting some kind of rendering of the real, the most relevant, or the useful knowledge, when in fact, you know, you might have just gotten the dud tweak to the algorithm in this very important search for something having to do with your health or who knows what. And I think that's a problem, you know, and it's a problem to the extent that we trust these companies to be able to deliver a product, which is to say knowledge in this case, in the case of Google, or, you know, particular results looking for, you know, commodities or what have you. You know, and not knowing the nature of the kind of play that's going on here with the algorithm, I think is a real detriment to people who are using these services.
And this also, this links us back to the commerce question, and it links us back to some of the things you're working on, Hector, right? Because the other question about that A-B testing that Google does is, what are they looking for to decide which test was the better one? So again, there's no outside measure of relevance. So they can't just say, ah, we found the more relevant searches. What are they looking at in the activity of the people in group A and the people in group B to decide which of these was better? Now, part of it could be, you know, people coming back for more. It could be, you know, time they spent. It could be whether they clicked the top couple searches. But those are proxies for what was successfully relevant. And in there is that mix of other questions, those commercial questions, which is something like, do they spend more time here? Do they come back faster? Are they, you know, the kind of good customers that work in the Google universe, not just did they walk away with a successful search experience? So either of those measures has nothing to do with relevance. It's success, satisfaction, return. These are all proxies, but they're proxies that are inflected with Google's need to have a business which, and this is where it links, I think, to what you work on, Hector, that need people to come back, that need people to participate, that need people to search again tomorrow or a minute from now or an hour from now.
My question, I thought this was really interesting what both of you were talking about, is so we've talked about the politics of algorithms. We've talked about algorithms as, you know, the cultures that come out of algorithms. But are we now arguing for an ethics of algorithms? In other words, when we talked about journalism, we talked about, well, let's say, I guess the fourth estate or you know, and the kind of ethics. When you teach journalism, right, there are these ethics that go along with the recirculation of knowledge. So are we arguing, kind of what I'm hearing is an argument for an ethics of algorithms?
Well, I've been trying to make this comparison a little bit lately, this idea that it would be fruitful to think about the position algorithms hold and the position that journalistic objectivity holds. And both of them are doing a kind of knowledge assurance. And what's interesting about journalistic objectivity is that it has these two layers. It has this promise, this ideal, and journalism studies have spent a lot of time sort of unpacking that and demonstrating that, you know, it's more ritual and it's never attained in practice and it's actually doing kind of strategic work. So this promise and ideal, and that matches to this idea that the algorithm is sort of neutral and cold and calculational and people are, you know, their hands are off it. And then beneath journalistic objectivity as an ideal was in fact a set of practices. Now those practices were messy, they were institutionalized, they were imperfect, but they were real, they existed, and they continue to exist, and they had a lot to do with a set of institutions committing to a set of goals. These are hard goals to commit to because you are both sustaining a business and sustaining a journalistic enterprise. They had to do with ethics, with professionalization. So what are the practices beneath algorithmic objectivity, right? Beneath the sheen of Google takes 0.004 seconds and here's a billion searches in ranked order, or here are the top trends for your region, enjoy. What are the practices beneath those? And part of what we've been thinking about is this idea that the algorithms obscure practices in all sorts of ways. Now, I don't have a lot of access to the practices of journalists either, right? So they're obscure to me in other ways. But this idea that there might be some component, right? An ethical component, an institutional component, a professional component. What's happening inside of Google or at the table at Facebook or at YouTube where they're deciding about tweaks to the algorithm or upgrades to the algorithm? What kind of conversations are those? Do those sound like? What is the mix of commercial imperative, technological obligation or limitation, and something like commitment to the public, commitment to the user, ethics of knowledge, right? Where do those things crop up and how are they resolved?
Yeah, no, I think those are all really good issues. And I love the analogy that you draw, Tarleton, to the journalistic profession, of which I've been a part for a period of time as a photojournalist. And so it really, you know, hits home to me. And I think in some ways, that's also the nature of some of these concerns, the way in which they get raised, at least for me on a personal level. You know, it's interesting to think about the model of journalism also, you know, and what it offers and what it shows is perhaps lacking in the tech world. And the figure that most immediately comes to mind is the figure of the ombudsperson, right? The person who is employed at the newspaper, or at least some newspapers, particularly the most, you know, significant ones, the ones of record, that are essentially there to make sure that, you know, the journalists, the editors, and others are doing the work that is expected of them, you know, to whatever extent it is possible, you know, to be fair and accurate and to be objective and to report an issue complexly. And I don't think that figure by and large exists in these companies or these corporations that we're talking about. And, you know, in some ways, I think it also reflects a larger sense of the culture out of which Google and other institutions are born. You know, it's one that is, you know, anti-statist to greater and lesser degrees. resistant to forms of centralized authority. And so, you know, we're also talking about a kind of culture clash, you know, that the way a newsroom is organized is in by no stretch of the imagination the way in which a Silicon Valley corporation is organized. It just doesn't work that way. And I think, you know, for better and for worse. And so the issue that we need to think about, and getting back to the issue of ethics, is, you know, is there such a way to reinflect the culture of Silicon Valley or the culture of high-tech companies so that they do actually start to think more deliberately about these kinds of issues? I mean, you know, usually the answer when we're talking about questions of ethics and fairness is, oh, well, we just need to write a program for that. And you know, we'll figure out how to make it work. But I think what we're all of the comments in this conversation are bumping up against is that there is only so far one can go with a computer program. And it's not to say that they can't become incredibly sophisticated. I mean, you know, they're made of millions of lines of code in some situations. But at the end of the day, there is a kind of conversation that I think is integral to the work of culture and a kind of oversight that cannot simply be reduced to a computer program. Because again, you know, we're talking about culture here. You know, culture, there's a reason why Raymond Williams says culture is one of the two or three most complicated words in the English language. It is that. And I think to the extent that it is that, the ethical questions that get raised are not simply reducible to a matter of some kind of management. You know, and the one thing that I always say when people ask me about the ethics question, because it comes up again and again, you know, is to think about how culture was, you know, managed, argued over, and how it continues to be to greater and lesser degrees, the algorithmic stuff notwithstanding. And, you know, that's what I love about culture, is that it is to greater and lesser degrees an argument. It's a bunch of people who come together for whatever reason and try to figure out what is best, what is right, what is most ethical, what is most enjoyable about a world. But we know that that's an ongoing conversation, an ongoing argument. But how do you have an argument with Google? You know, you can click the "these search results didn't quite meet my expectations" button, but that's not the same as having an argument and having a debate with your friend. And I think to the extent that we haven't managed to realize that in these algorithmic companies or these algorithmically driven companies, we haven't quite fully embraced the hard work of culture, technologically speaking.
All right, so now I have another question in terms of, because what we're talking about is sort of, it's interesting because, you know, if you look at it, okay, so if you look at it as a sort of a production and consumption kind of thing, right, then when we search on Google, when we search wherever, we're actually in, you know, there's search behavior, right? So there's reasons why you're a searcher. You may want to buy something. Usually it's information. You want to learn something. You want to consume that information so that maybe you can consume something else. But there's also a production side to that, right? That you, by that search, by those key terms, by whatever, you're contributing to that interface, right? That's being captured in some way. And then it's being noted, right? And it's being noted, analyzed, and then used for the next version of the algorithm that will do the process of regurgitating and giving you the information. So are there So if we're talking about algorithms that give information, that aggregate, right, like the trends or the search output, what can we say about algorithms that capture? And this is sort of like my shtick, right, the idea of capturing what we put in. What is there, and how do we think through algorithms that capture? Is that even something worthwhile, or is it just, well, it just happens, it's a lot of noise, and the algorithms on the other side is what's making sense of the noise? Or are algorithms on the front end inviting certain kinds of things, right? And it's sort of like an iterative process where we invite X, we get X, and we sell X, right? So it's back and forth over and over again.
I think there's certainly something to be said about the way that a provider, and of course these providers have algorithms as key tools to them, want to enlist and encourage activity, and the way that the algorithm becomes a sort of target for that. And I think there's a really interesting tension with the thing we were talking about before, right? So Google and Twitter and Facebook don't want you to know too much about how their algorithms work, because they want to avoid the bad participation that's you know, on the best level, search engine optimization, on the worst level, spam and, gaming the system. So they have to be oblique about how they work. At the same time, they want participation. And so they want the good version, which is you show up, you know how to sound, you throw hashtags into your tweets so that you can be recirculated. And the same kinds of strategies that we use in all sorts of cultural fora, where we want to orient ourselves towards how we might be heard. We want to orient ourselves towards how we might be redistributed. And we have examples of that way before algorithms. So, submitting your press release in time for the news to run at 6 p.m. or sending them prepackaged video because you know it's going to fit well on cable news. There's an orientation towards the tool. And there's a really interesting tension about the tool or the provider wanting to reveal enough workings and teach you well enough such that you can do that. And I think hashtags are a great example of that, right? Where it's both a kind of homegrown activity, a provided activity, an activity that then gets reinforced because the hashtags become the thing that get picked up and re-pitched back to you as trends. They become clickable and those clicks take you to other people. And so, of course, we learned and innovated and began to, fill our tweets with hashtags as a way to encode ourselves into a set of discussions. If you can click on this word in my tweet and it's going to connect you to 100 other things, then people are going to click back to mine. And that's a way that people turn to face the algorithm. But they're turning to face something that can't be entirely revealed to them, or else it'll be a system gamed.
That's such a great explanation, Tarleton. And I loved the line where you talked about the orientation toward the tool, because I think that really captures it cuts right to the heart of these kinds of issues. And what's interesting to me to think about the production question, Hector, that you've raised, is to think about the kind of philosophy of senses or sensation that gets built into these tools. You know, that in a sense, what's happening increasingly is that we're creating tools that are, sensitive to different parts of the world that arguably, machines have not been sensitive to before necessarily, and that they are, in a sense, informationalizing aspects of the world that were not previously informationalized. So those self-driving Google cars are a very good example of this, right? That, increasingly we're turning our public highways into an information space, and that these Google cars are, measuring the distance between cars, velocity, relative velocity, and so on and so forth. And, what that does then is it creates a certain awareness of the tools that are at our disposal, just as Tarleton said, and then does encourage us to use those tools accordingly. And, I think that is a process ultimately then of reification, or at least partial reification, as Tarleton was noting. And I'm really looking forward to reading Jonathan Stern's new book. It's called MP3, The Meaning of a Format. And I know he's not someone who is writing a lot about algorithms as much as he's writing about media formats. But I think in some ways, the question of capture and algorithms and format are all totally interrelated, because we're talking about producing an informationalized world, or an increasingly informationalized world. And what we're doing then is, creating new dispositions, new habits, new modes of conduct, I think, that will ultimately become a part of our daily lives. And I imagine most of, at least you two, have seen that promotional video that came out, I guess, a couple months ago for the Google Glasses that are being developed right now by Google, which are essentially a kind of heads-up display. They're really dorky right now, but they're a heads-up display that is supposed to kind of overlay vital information about your world, whether it's, subways, whether it's about road construction delays, and any number of other things. And it's interesting to start thinking about these kinds of increasingly immersive environments.
Right. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but right. It's the idea of immersion, but also the kind of immersion that happens when you're not really aware of the immersiveness, right? So the technologies are pervasive, they're all over the place, and we're sort of moving through this matrix of information that is inviting us to participate and at the same time, capturing the things that we do. So I don't want to be on the last note, but I think we're running out of time. So I'd like to maybe take this opportunity now to wrap up and to say thank you to both Ted and Tarleton for joining us, and asking our audience to please tune in again for the next installment, which will be with Casey O'Donnell. from Michigan State University, and T.L. Taylor from MIT.
Thanks, Hector. And thanks also to Ted. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Hector, for having me be a part of the podcast. And Tarleton, what a great pleasure to speak with you about our shared interest in algorithms.